Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we're giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic. And we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 116th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. I'm Matt Enlow.
I'm Oren Kaplan. This episode is brought to you by patrons Matt Barber, Jordan Brady, Dempsey K. Tapley, Ryan Moulton, Jonathan Finn Holiday, David, Nathan Blackwell, Nathan Presley, Artemis, and Luke Sheldon.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah, if you want to be a patron and help us out with the podcast, help us get our editors paid and everything, check our Patreon out at patreon.com/justshootitpod.
Even just a buck helps. Thanks, everyone. Today, we've got a great episode. I just shot a short film. I've got a ton of learnings that I want to bring to the table, talk about. It's a great experience. And Oren, you just shot a giant commercial campaign.
Yeah, we are just shooting things right and left. My shoot flipped to Union. We're going to talk about that. I'm also prepping for a pilot that is kind of lower budget than I wanted.
So we're going to talk about being resourceful. It's a Matt and Oren episode.
Very long catch up. And before we get into that, here's an iTunes review. A review from MJ Draper. MJ gives us 5 out of 5 stars and says, "A great resource for aspiring and veteran filmmakers alike. I've been an actor for years, but I've only just recently began to understand the power of creating my own content. Having only identified with the acting side of things, I've been terrified to write my own scripts, let alone direct projects. But this podcast has been an amazing resource and has really helped guide me as I navigate these new concepts. Thanks for the great guests, unpaid endorsements, and thoughtful dialogue. Keep up the great work."
Hey, thanks, MJ.
Yeah, thanks, MJ. Thanks to you. I do feel like a surprisingly high number of actors listen to this podcast. Shout out to Dave Stanbra, who gives me a kind of live tweet commentary about each episode we put out. I don't know if this is true, but I do think that the more actors know about what's going on behind the camera, the better they can be at their job.
Yeah, definitely. So, Oren.
Yes.
What have you been working on lately?
Well, I've had actually a busy few weeks, which has been really exciting. I just wrapped a campaign I did for Xfinity, which is a Comcast brand. It's a cable company. We shot 10 spots over the course of 3 days. So it was like 3 30-second spots and 7 10-second social spots. And we shot like the 30-second spots on day 1 and 2. And we shot all 7 of the socials on day 3. The socials are 10 seconds each.
Yeah, man. Rock and roll. All 16:9, or were there any like
1x1ers? So the 30-second ones were 16:9. And the socials, we freaking did it. It's my first time. All 9x16. We got the 90-degree plate. We had 2 cameras. Put them side by side, and we shot everything vertically. In theory, 1x1 safe, so it means you can like crop a square out of the middle of it.
So you shot vertically and horizontally simultaneously?
No, vertically and vertically.
Wait, why did you do 2 vertical? For your A and B camera. They weren't side by side. You mean like stacked, not...
Well, yeah, stacked. So it was a 2-shot. Pretty much all of them were a 2-shot and a single. I just messaged you and through Google Messages some frames. Did you see them?
Yeah. Oh, it looks good.
So what I'm showing Matt right now are some of the frames from like the first cuts, and they have a lot of text because these are, so the social spots, what's interesting about them is they need to work without sound also. So they usually tend to have a lot of text on them. And so because we're shooting 9x16, you have just like a ton of room to put the text above your characters.
Because wides are really tricky to get. So composing for 9x16, like a portrait, like a single always looks really good. But like if you want to get a little bit more of the environment, you end up with a ton of extra negative space that's kind of hard to deal with. But this text looks great.
Yeah.
This looks awesome, man.
Oh,
looks
thanks.
Super good. Yeah.
But no, the big problem with shooting vertically is dolly track is hard to get out of your frame, and the boom mic is pretty much impossible to put above your actors.
So did you ever do lock-offs and then just like mat out the boom?
Well,
like shoot a plate and then mat it out?
The sad truth about 10-second social videos is you almost never get to do dolly shots.
Yeah, sure.
If you're doing any coverage. If it's a one-shot video, sure. But because all these videos have like 3 or 4 shots in them, which means each shot is on the screen for 2 to 3 seconds, you know, they have all this text and selling stuff and a few shots are screens.
Yeah.
So you just don't have time to move the camera. So we didn't move the camera, and it was supposed to be all MOS, right? Because none of these spots rely on dialogue because people like just scroll through them on Snapchat or Instagram or whatever. So we had everyone loved. And actually in the edits, they ended up using some of the stuff that people improvised, which I was happy about.
I thought you said nobody ever uses improv horn.
Yeah, you're right. Nobody does. I guess I'm the first person to use improv. No, you know, there was like a lot of reactions like, like yells or screams.
Yeah,
it's basically all these people playing video games and watching sports and getting excited. But one of the things that the client asked for at the very last minute was to put a marching band in the background of one of the scenes. And I was like, okay, so these are 9x16 and you are giving us a 12-person marching band. Like, how the hell do you frame like the widest thing you can possibly think of in the tallest frame possible? So I actually sent you, do you see that last frame, that kid watching a video with a chicken and there's a marching band behind him?
Yeah.
So the client actually had an idea. I was like, I don't know, marching band's really wide. How do we see him? And they're like, well, can't we just see them marching through the frame, like a few people at a time? And I was like,
Yeah,
I guess so.
And then you have fewer actors as well.
Yeah, well, I had my marching band march in a loop, so the whole time they're marching. I will say that one of the tricky things about these 10-second commercials is, I'm sure you've had the same experience, but when you work with an agency and a client and they've spent all this money, we just spent whatever, $10,000 to get this marching band. We want to shoot a ton of stuff with a marching band and get all these alts and all these different versions. But you as a director are like, well, how many versions do we need? Because I need time to shoot more coverage and make sure all the other stuff is perfect.
I love playing as well, but part of your job is prioritizing
because
you've got other things to shoot. Yeah,
but so many times, like, the creative director would be like, oh, let's just try to take it like this. Oh, what if this happens and then this happens? And they're all great ideas, but I was like, dude, that will never, this shot needs to be 3 seconds long, you know?
Yeah.
So these two things, like, they high-five each other, jump up, and do a dance. That's like 5 seconds. That does not fit into this commercial. So I found myself on set, like, one of my real important jobs was, like, trying to really clearly nail one beat per shot and trying to kind of rein in all the great ideas into, like, you know, very
one
much
thing.
Say, like, those are great ideas. That's super funny. We could try it, but in my opinion, this isn't going to make it into the cut because it takes too long, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, the politics of directing, I think the higher up you get, like, the more other people who have a say.
Right. So you feel bad, right?
Yeah.
You're like, that's a great idea, but it's just not going to work.
You know, I think we were talking about this before, but there's a weird thing where you get high up and all of a sudden you've got other people to please and it's not just you. You're kind of the middle of the sandwich, as I like to say. And there's a little bit of like jealousy that sort of comes up in me, at least, where it's like I want to be pitching crazy ideas and trying all these like fun things and, you know, just spread my wings creatively. But I also know that the sun's going to be going down in a few hours.
Right.
And so, like, I'm jealous that these people can be sticklers or be, they're unencumbered by the realities of filmmaking in a way that, like, due to experience and planning and prep, like, no one knows the project like we do from an execution standpoint, especially. That just makes it all so complicated.
But also just from being on so many sets and having done this so many times, like, you know that at some point one of your actors is going to have to go to the bathroom, you know, and you're all just going to sit there waiting. Like, you know that, like, some piece of wardrobe isn't going to look right. Or, like, like, we had this chicken mascot costume, and it was wearing a shirt that said, you know, name of a college on it. And it just kept, every time the chicken was dancing or moving around, like, the shirt would wrinkle. So we, you know, every time the client would be like, the shirt's wrinkled. The shirt doesn't look good. The shirt. And I'm like, it's fine. Obviously, we want to fix it. But before, when we're on the calls before the shoot, and the client's like, what's going to take so long? We won't be nitpicky. Like, just go. Just shoot. It's going to be real fast.
Yeah, yeah.
You're like, okay, it's not, it's not about you being nitpicky. It's literally things we just have to do. Like, we have to call last looks when someone's hair looks crazy, you know? Or when somebody spills some water on their pants and now there's a stain on their pants, you know,
yeah,
a wet spot on their pants. It's not anything under our control, or people are trying to walk through the set. So
yeah, I think about, I can't remember who I'm stealing this from, but I remember reading an article where they said that basically, like, production is a situation where you're trying to drive cross country and you've timed it out so that you think you're going to hit every single green light.
Right, exactly. But that's, I feel like, our job as the director and the producer to some degree is,
right,
to
be,
say,
like, well, no, we're going to hit a few reds.
Yeah, and there will be some yellow lights and we'll make some wrong turns and we'll have to recover. And that happened on this shoot all the time. It was like, here we go and here's the set. And the client's like, okay, what other couch options do we have?
Right.
And we're on the sixth floor of a building that has no working freight elevator. And the art team literally had to build the couch inside the apartment. And I'm like, we have two couches. You've seen both of them. We've got nothing else. I'm sorry. So, yeah. Anyway, the shoot was really fun. It was probably one of my bigger, just from a production standpoint, shoots I've had in a while. We had like eight trucks. I actually made a video I was maybe going to put on our website or something. And now I think I can. Originally, I was like, so we'll talk about this later, but the shoot was non-union, and it flipped to be union on day two. But when it was non-union and I was recording this, I was worried that, like, all the union crew members were, like, going to get weird with me recording them.
Right.
But I feel like now it's not weird anymore. And I guess I could blur their faces. I don't know. But basically, I just, like, walked down the sidewalk, you know. Here's the generator. Right. We had props had their own truck. You know, art had their own truck. Production had a truck. Camera had a truck. Grip had a truck. Electric had a truck. Production had, like, a big production moho with bathroom, makeup, wardrobe. And then we had one other truck, like a PA truck type of thing.
Plus transpo?
Yeah. Oh, and we had all these shuttles to shuttle people from the parking lot to there. And when we turned union, all those drivers had to be replaced by Teamsters, which is like...
Yeah. They're so expensive.
Very expensive.
The one thing that I really like about that, though, is that I feel like Teamsters... Like, so often on a non-union production, someone will just hire, like, a teenager or, like, a 25-year-old to drive the truck. And you're asking for it, right? When you get a Teamster, they can, like, back up a semi with their eyes shut through a 6-inch hole. You know what I mean? Like, they are so good at driving.
Yeah, their specialty is driving.
Yeah, and I like that much better because at least I know that we're in really good hands. And that, like, a person whose whole vocation is driving is the person driving these, frankly, very...
Right.
Unwieldy vehicles.
Driving very big wheels. While I totally agree, I will say the drivers we did have were also very experienced. It wasn't like 18-year-old PAs. It was like, you know, people with 10 years of experience in the art department. And
now they're
camera people.
Out of a job or whatever. Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, they were doing other stuff for the art department as well. You know, a lot of them were union members. And because of that, we flipped, you know. But anyway, so... Because we had such a big kind of footprint, right? So I'm sure most of our listeners know, but some people don't. Like when you have like a bigger production and you're going to scout a house or an apartment or a restaurant, one of the things the producer or the locations manager is looking for is like how much sidewalk space we need. You know, we need 100 feet of sidewalk. We need 200 feet of sidewalk to park all our things. And they need to go get permission from all the places they're parking in front of to park the trucks, right? And if there's houses, it's a residential neighborhood, you have to get permission from the neighbors to shoot there. It's a whole big involved thing that luckily we usually don't have to deal with. So on this production, because we had all these needs, we had one location move, and it was a location move to a place that was less than a mile away, and it took two full hours.
Yeah, yeah. The drive time is not really a big variable in a company move. Like, it can be if it's like more than 20 minutes away, but the real time suck is just in the load in and out.
And I'm sure everyone knows what a company move is, but it's basically when you wrap one location, load all your stuff onto the trucks, all your actors, all the everything, and move to a different location and restart the whole day at the new location. And it's usually like a pretty big restart because you have to strap everything down when you're driving, right? And unstrap, right. Load, and unload. It's like it's almost takes you as long to start up at the second location as it did at the first location. The only difference is maybe some of the actors have already been through hair and makeup.
Mate, but they all need touch-ups and stuff still. It's like starting over, effectively.
Yeah, which is why you do anything in your power to avoid a company move. And so on this shoot, in those first three commercials, we had like 8 locations or something, but I tried to find 2 locations that could work for 8 locations.
Right.
Anyway, so that was really fun. Sorry, that was a really long summary of what I did last week. But what I'm doing next week is I'm shooting this pilot presentation for E. I think I talked about this on the podcast before. But so the way E does their pilot program is they give you a pretty small amount of money to basically shoot. It's like a proof of concept, but it's like a 12 to 15 minute like mini version of the episode.
Mm-hmm. And is the concept that you're presenting or the thing you're shooting, is it meant to go on air in success, or is it purely a proof of concept and everyone knows they'll reshoot things?
It's purely a presentation, which is why you can do like the 12 minute version of what would traditionally be a 22 minute show.
Right.
And one of the things is like the script for our pilot presentation has so many things that would be impossible to legally clear. Mm-hmm. Because it's a show with all these historical recreations where we take a lot of objects and posters and things from the past that, and even a few video clips that I think normally you would have to pay for if it goes to air.
Right.
But I guess when I took the job, I obviously still would have taken the job, but I didn't realize how incredibly small the budget is. And so now I'm finding myself really having to do a lot of the producing, like line producing, mm-hmm. not having to do it, but really get deep in there because my art person who says, you know, this is a 6-person job gets one assistant, you know, and my DP who says this is like, I need at least 4 people to light the stage is getting one person, you know, mm-hmm. and I need he said the budget for lighting was somewhere between $6,000 and $8,000 and they told him he can have $500, you know?
Right.
So when you're in that situation, like how do you even start approaching that? Like he literally on the low end thinks he needs 12 times as much money as they are offering. So what do we do? It's weird because all the rates, the crew rates are fine, but there's just barely any crew.
Yeah, it's a weird thing that I've experienced just recently where you're like, oh, this is a name brand. Everyone's heard of this thing and, you know, the company creating it and the rates are good. Normally the rate is the thing when you're first offered to come onto a project. They're like, oh, this is what you're making. That's the thing that really indicates the scale of the production that you're doing. So if it's a good rate, then you're happy that you're making money, but also that like you're relieved because it feels like, oh, I'm going to have the resources to pull this ambitious thing off. And now I'm really excited for it. And it's a weird switcheroo. And I think it kind of comes out of the non-scripted disciplines. So like if you're working with a company that's used to reality or doc or something like that, or talking heads, that sort of stuff, then they have a totally different mindset for what it takes to shoot a thing, you know?
Right. So like this company I'm working with has done all unscripted things before, right? And unscripted in our world means like reality shows or news shows or interview shows, things like that. So they had like a 2-person sound team, which I don't, you know, I could probably live with 1 person. They had like a 6-person camera team and 3 cameras, which I could probably survive with 1 camera. I'd like to have 2 just because we're shooting so much. But they had like 1 person on lighting and 1 person on art, which those departments are where I'm like, what? I need way more on art and lighting, right? And so it's interesting. They also like we need to shoot in a restaurant, and I was trying to find kind of affordable restaurants, and they sent me this one restaurant location. I was like, wow, this is like, it's like a $4 sign restaurant. It's beautiful, glass walls, everything. And the EP was like, yeah, this place is affordable. And I was like, oh, really? That I'm like shocked that this is affordable, right? Because right. Like what I would pay for dinner there is probably as much as our entire budget. And so I was going on the assumption we could shoot there. And then when I had a meeting with them in person, they said, oh yeah, they said we can like shoot in the corner. They're not going to shut down the restaurant for us, but we can shoot there for a couple hours.
Right.
And I was like, we need the whole restaurant. We need it for 12 hours. We need to be able to unplug refrigerators and do all that stuff. Like I can't, like I could maybe do it in 6 to 8 hours if you want, but then I'd have to do a company move to somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like a whole different thing. I wonder when you did Ellen, did you guys ever do that where you just walked into a place, you know, put up like a Kino or a Quasar tube or something and just shot three cameras and left? I guess even when I saw you, that's kind of how we shot that that zip line place.
Well, they...
I don't think there was even lighting there, right?
We would light sometimes and sometimes we wouldn't. Yeah, and it's because I think that in general, you can like... You can get away with... Cameras are so good now, and if you hire skilled people who have good taste, I think you can always find a spot or two where the lighting looks nice. And if you're just doing an interview for 15 minutes, then you're not worried about that light moving or anything like that. Like you don't need to control things and you can just roll with the punches. And I think that like coming from that discipline and that world, you don't pull out lights all the time.
Right. And you're also shooting for like 20 minutes for something that'll end up being 20 seconds. Right. And you have three cameras,
exactly.
You have so much coverage and you are building the best parts of it in post.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of the time you're just looking for that sound bite in the interview that's like, oh my God, I can't believe this thing happened. Or like, I was so scared and then everything turned out great. I love everyone. You know, like it's designed for a totally different piece, you know, like field packages for a daytime TV show or a variety show. The audience expectation is that it's okay for it to be a little rough around the edges. You know, like if you were shooting something for Jimmy Kimmel, like, you know, you want it to look awesome and like talented people can run around and do that very quickly. The audience understands that their turnaround is really fast. So they're more forgiving in a strange way, I think. I don't know.
Right. You know, it is interesting working. I think I talked about this before, how they had story producers and APs, you know, when I just wanted like a production manager and like a production designer. But yeah, so it's kind of, so this is what I'm doing. First of all, well, we have two Alexas, which in theory you could change those out to be C300s. And again, this shoot is a presentation, so it's not going to air, right?
But if the better
it
looks...
I want it to be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, the better it looks, the more likely it will go to air.
Right. So we're sticking with the two Alexas. We went from getting like a full-on Steadicam with an operator. We switched that person out for our DP with a Movi, which I'm not crazy about because I wanted to design the show in a way where it's almost all Steadicam shots. Very much like Adam Ruins Everything style.
Yeah.
So people walking around, talking to camera, talking to things, you know. So I think it'll be clunkier with the Movi and the DP who's worried about 10 other things, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the producers were like, well, what if we give you a Steadicam one day and then you can, you don't have it all the days. I'm like, well, but that's the whole language of the show is Steadicam. So what, we'll have it in the opening sequence, but not in any other scene. So I'm really fighting for the Steadicam. So that's something I'm not willing to compromise on. But what I did do, which I think I mentioned to you, is we actually have a listener, Marshall Lemming, who had emailed me and offered, hey, I will hook you up with a free crew if you want. We all graduated from film school. We're all moving to LA. If you ever want free crew, let me know, you know, just within reason, just for a couple days.
Right.
So I hit him up and he's going to help me out. There are all these, you know, we're going to see how it all works. I think to make sure everyone's insured and stuff, you have to pay them something. But again, it's like, closer to $150 a day than $600 a day.
Right,
Is kind of, so I don't know. So that's one thing I'm doing. And then I'm just like going through the script and slashing things. And I'm like, hey, there's 85 props. There's literally a scene where this woman has an Afghan, you know, like a blanket. mm-hmm. that has like certain words like stitched into it. And I'm we can do that, but that's going to take all the art resources for this one joke.
Right.
That's not even necessary. So I'm just trying to fix it at a script level to make it less art intensive. So yeah, it's tricky. So you just had a shoot. You just did a short film and you self-financed it. So you probably had similar things too.
Yeah, I did. So after I had been on that job for the last couple of months, I really wanted to do something scripted. And also I realized it's been kind of a while for me for when I have shot something that I wrote. I've been writing a lot and selling those scripts and then not shooting them. And I've been shooting a lot, but it's all scripts that other people have written. And so, you know, that's going to change relatively soon. And obviously, like, I do a pass on stuff all the time. But yeah, it's been kind of a while since I wrote something that I saw all the way through. And so I wanted to do that again, and it had been a while. And also, I think it was an exercise in just shooting it. Just kind of like knowing that without it being totally insane or life-altering, I could call in a few favors and borrow some gear and go shoot something. And it was interesting, man. It was like I'm still wrapping my head around the emotional journey that it was, because it was, it was self-financed, and I did cut certain corners that we are both used to having on sets that I kind of chafed out a little bit. But also, it's fascinating to be around a crew that small, but at a very experienced level. It was basically as though my film school buddies all spent a decade leveling up and getting awesome, but then came back and made a student project again. The crew was me, our two actors, a DP, an AC, sound, producer, a PA.
Any makeup, wardrobe?
Makeup and wardrobe, yeah. Yeah, so still.
And art?
No art.
Were you?
I was
you're art. The art department.
Yeah, yeah.
And was you filmed at Madeline's?
And we
house,
yeah,
our producer.
So we producer / site rep Madeline. Yeah,
cool. Was she there when you were filming?
She was. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So I imagine when you work with really experienced people, you gain something, but there's also a tiny bit of a loss, right? Because I would think you gain experience. They know what to do. Mm-hmm. They're efficient. They make good stuff. You can count on them. They know what they're doing. There's very few mistakes.
Yeah, I had a gaffer too. Yeah.
Oh, and a gaffer. But what you lose is maybe that excitement of like, hey, we're all on a set together and this is so fun and we're like a family and we're like doing this and we're following chasing our dreams.
It was like a good, you know, I have like a knack for bringing people who have great attitudes to set. So it wasn't a coincidence that everybody there was like really cool and in a great mood and got along and like, you know, they were all friends. Like, I think everybody had worked with a few other people at any given time, you know? So, like, it was a small crew of people that had all, you know, they were all at least one degree away from each other, even if you took me out of the equation, you know? So, like, so in that way, it was fun. But, yeah, it wasn't like camp. It wasn't, it was friendly, but it wasn't like everyone's best friends at the end and like they're gonna miss each other so much, you know.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. When you're doing a short like this with your experienced friends, and I'm assuming you're paying them nothing or barely anything, how important is it for you to pitch to them that you're making something special, you know? Like, do you say like, this is why I'm making this short, this is why it's important, this is why it's going to be good, and this is why you should be a part of it?
I think that it's a mix. I think that there were people there, and that's making me realize how lucky I am, because I think there were people there who, like, you know, the script would have been garbage and they were there to help me out. I'm pretty loyal. I'm pretty good about getting those people's names out. You know, I make sure I refer them whenever I can. So, like, this is a town of recommendations, and I get hit up for recommendations all the time because I tell people I want to recommend people. And so, yeah, there were plenty of people who would have just like done it because you know.
I will say a quick aside, a lot of times people email Matt and me, especially if they're like directors and they're looking for a crew person, and Matt is very good. He'll always send back like a list. Try one of these six people.
Yeah.
Do you have it organized like in an Excel spreadsheet
and that,
or something?
That is thanks to my wife, Chrissy. She puts together a crew list. We'll like tear down, like we'll take a look at a call sheet. We'll pull our favorites. So the people that like really like hit it out of the park. Like we have notes, like we have an Excel sheet of all the positions. Yeah. And it's explicitly so that I can refer them later. Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. I was so shocked by how easy it comes to you. And I'm like, let me find this call sheet.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there might be a person.
And it's genuinely because I remember when we were doing Squaresville, one of the things that really was a big incentive was like getting people's names out there to our peers who were looking for good crew members. And I remember my production designer had just moved to town, and literally she said, like, for the first year or two, 100% of her income was through my referrals.
Oh, damn. Did she give you a percentage?
No, but she would have come out for this job for free if she was available. She was just booked on something.
Mm. You shouldn't have recommended her.
Yeah. Now she's doing TV and killing it. And I love that. I want that to happen. So that's kind of the point. The other half of that coin is like, yeah, it has to be good. And I think that that's like the difference between what, where you are in your career, basically. Like, what do you need, you know?
Right.
But in every circumstance, I'd worked with all of them a bunch of times.
Cool. And so how'd you do? Did you just not do any art since there was no art department?
So one of the things that was really like fortunate and well-timed is that because Madeline, our producer, was so kind to lend us her apartment, volunteer her apartment. We got in the day before and loaded in a bunch of stuff and then did rehearsals in the space with the DP as well. So we did like, we blocked through everything. Like we kind of knew how everything was going to feel and where everyone was going to be so that we could pre-light basically. And that day I spent kind of figuring out what the angles would be and then also what we needed to dress. But, you know, it's an apartment, so like we didn't have to do too much.
Right, and when you're saying you figured out what angles, would you like take the camera and walk around and look at the screen?
Or did you have a lens on a stick? Like, it's not like we went with Artemis, but I just knew what walls I was going to see, basically. Like where the action was going to happen. And because it's also simple, it's two characters in a room or a couple different rooms. So it wasn't like it was overly complicated. Yeah, I like did very little. I swapped out some lamps and like, you know, added some bedding and things like that.
And so when you make a short like that, do you tell like your reps and stuff, your manager, your
lawyer, you know,
whatever? Are you like, hey, I'm making a short and this is going
to
like...
I mentioned it to them a little bit. I think once it's done and I can send them a link, that's when they'll be like, oh, I see. Because they hear short and like they don't care until it wins Sundance, basically, right. You know. Or until they can send it to people or they say, oh, this is a perfect sample. Now you can get on Modern Family or whatever. You know, like they'll be glad that I made it and excited by it, but not until it's done, basically.
Well, cool. Well, any other takeaways from that project?
Any other takeaways? I mean, I feel like so many. Like I said, I'm still processing them. It was a mission accomplished in that, like, we did it. You know, like it's not that crazy to just like write a script, send it to your friends, get notes, rewrite it, tell everybody.
And you produced
it,
right?
I did with my friend Jill Jask, who is also a great producer. So that was the interesting thing. I think when you level up, it's also a thing of like you realize how many things you don't know about anymore, you know, like right. All of that behind the scenes stuff or like who tiny things that you just never like. Do you know, Oren, who brings the CFast card reader for an Alexa on a shoot? Whose job it is to have that?
The DIT? I don't know. I would think the camera team.
It could be from the camera rental and we borrowed it. It could be the DIT. The DIT is likely to have it. But I didn't know. And I only had an AC and a DP and a borrowed camera. And it was like that morning I was like, do I have a card reader for this? And we had to go buy one.
Oh, how much does that cost?
$30. You know.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah, wasn't bad.
But probably frustrating.
Yeah. So.
Well, cool. Well, you said it was emotional. Is that what you were talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that like it was emotional in that I've got all my friends making this thing with me. And like there's the anxiety of like, oh, is this going to be good? you know, I brought all of them here. Like, they're all doing great work. And also, like, none of them ever said this at all, but, like, doing way more jobs than they're used to. You know what right. I mean? Like,
they have less support than
they have less support than they're used to. Yeah. So, like, my AC also did all of the data management. And my DP did an awful lot of lighting and rigging. You know, like, just stuff that they haven't done in a long time. And did it with a smile and with compassion. And, like, it was great. But I felt responsible for that. And so the pressure for it to be good, because they're there because they want it to be good. You know, they're not there for any other reason other than to be nice to me, is an extra weird level of pressure, you know? Like, like when we do a job and everybody's making the rate that they are happy to make, if it's bad,
they don't care.
They don't care, exactly. And so being the writer and also having my wife star in it and also having all my friends in it, it's like just an extra level of psychic energy that I just wasn't thinking about.
Well, let me ask you about that for a second. How, I mean, I know obviously you've worked with Chrissy before, but how is it directing your wife in a scene that's kind of based on you and your wife, but you are not playing you?
Yeah. You know, it's based on... just to clarify, I should have set this up earlier. But so it's about basically a couple that they're in their 30s. They don't have kids. They love their lives. And she finds a gray pubic hair. And they have an ensuing conversation about age and their trajectory and what they want out of life, basically, as a result of it. And kind of spin out of control. It is ripe content for...
people in our life, in our stage of life.
Yeah, in our stage of life, and like the people who are making the movie with us. And so, you know, it's got like real emotional heft. And also, you know, I've said pube more times on that day than I had in my total life combined, probably. You know, like they're holding a gray pube and talking about it and doing focus racks to it. And, you know, like it's like a pube joke on top of everything. So, you know, the thing is that my wife's a pro. And like, you know, there's some implied nudity and like... there's some stuff that could make a person uncomfortable. And I think because she is so good, it made everything easy.
But since she's playing kind of herself, do you ever say like, you know, this is like you, so pretty much just do what you would do? Is there that conversation?
No, we didn't have that conversation because she's not really playing herself, actually.
It's a you-like person.
Yeah, I mean... is she
my
like
voice.
A woman who is in a long-term relationship and doesn't have a kid and is in her 30s? Yes. There were personal conversations about it in terms of like how people are going to perceive it or like what our parents are going to think or like, you know, that sort of stuff that is complicated and is emotional. And there were conversations of like, you know, you're doing that thing. You know, like, don't read it like that because people won't like that. You know, that did happen, but it all happened well before we were on stage. You know, like, one of the big advantages is, like, we got to rehearse together one-on-one and go through beat by beat the objectives and ideas and, like, take, basically, before we were shooting.
Something my wife, Kara, and I got into a little argument last night about something, and I was like, oh, man, this argument is, like, so... real and perfect. Mm-hmm. Like I kind of want to put it in my, mm-hmm. my screenplay that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. It's kind of about a couple like us a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, at its essence, they're very different from us in other ways. But I was like, well, I wonder if I put that in there, if that will like bother her. Do you ever do like, is that anything you're ever sensitive to?
I mean, I think that you have to write for emotional truth. Right. And the people who are close to you are they're going to read into things, but you're not going to be able to control the ways in which they read into them. You know, I feel like my parents, every time I tell them about a project, they're like, oh, well, is that about us? And sometimes the answer is yes. And sometimes the answer is like, no, it's about a kid I went to junior high with.
It's about a guy that keeps lying to his parents about things.
Yeah.
It's like, you're like, no, it's not about you.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I think you always start from that point of inspiration from your life. But I think then by the time you're in a final draft, things have changed so much and the circumstances have changed so much that like the people close to you have no right and absolutely every right getting mad at you about every single character and every single conflict that you write. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. That does remind me. I'm going to just make a note for myself to put that into my first act somewhere. My problem is I keep on coming up with new ideas for like character development in the first act. And at the end of the day, it's probably I'll need one of these like 50 things to happen.
Right, right.
So cool. So I think I need to make a short too. Can you send your crew list over?
I can, yeah. Yeah, it's equal parts like really awesome and exhilarating and exhausting. I slept all day yesterday.
Right, and now you need to edit it too, which is the most depressing part.
Well, I'm lucky I have another editor doing it, so I'm not going to do it.
Oh, have they started already?
Probably not. I think he's going to start in a couple days.
Cool.
But also, like, the edit is going to be pretty straightforward, honestly. I don't think it's going to be... Like, coverage is still pretty simple, and, like, I took a handful of takes, and, you know.
Yeah, but those are, like, famous last words.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
My brother, actually, he called me yesterday. He's like, hey, my brother's an engineer, but he, like, kind of likes making videos for fun, and he's like, hey... I just like edited this thing for someone and like the sound guy's asking for an OMF and I have no idea what that is. Can't I just give him my Premiere project? And I was like, no, it's like, you know, sound people, they need OMF files to put into Pro Tools or whatever. And he's like, well, he's going to add all the sound effects, right? He's like, I didn't really put any sound effects or ambience or anything in there. And I was like, well, then what did you do? Like, that's like, you know, what they say is that 70% right. of like the picture of the movie is sound. And so... I think like all those things, especially when it's like super straightforward. The thing that my brother was editing was like a one-shot short film.
Mm.
So there's not much editing. You know, he added some titles and retimed some things. And I'm like, but dude, that's your job is to like add all the sound effects.
Right.
Like, the sound mixer will balance them and maybe make them better or whatever. But like,
yeah.
you can't,
unless
the editor adds a sound, you know?
Yeah.
So I think like, even when you're like, oh, it's so straightforward. It's like those tiny little... things become so important, the atmospheric sounds, the music, the pacing, you know, the looks, the reactions. Anyway, I've seen, we have this friend who made this short film. I'm sure I told you about this, but he edited it, got rejected from every single film festival, right? It was kind of about his life. It was about his childhood in Orange County or something. Had some cool shots, but didn't really make much sense. Freaking Matt Barber, who's been on our podcast a bunch of times, went, he recut that short, got into Sundance, got into Cannes, got into Venice. Yeah, insane, right? So it's like, just goes to show you, not that you can fix any footage, but, you know, the edit. And if you watch the short, you're like, this short requires almost no editing. It's like these super wide shots that play out a whole scene in them and stuff. But it's,
wow.
There is setup and a pacing and a rhythm. And that's why when he was going to edit my feature, and I was so stoked, and then he... couldn't come to an agreement with my producers on the rate and the credit and the back end, and I was like so bummed.
So
I was
like,
this guy can take footage and get it into Sundance.
Yeah.
Anyway, shorts, man.
Yeah.
Making a comeback.
I think
Vimeo,
they are.
It's bringing them back.
You know what's so funny is the day before the shoot, I was like, I'm going to do this again. I can't wait. I've already got the next one in mind. This is going to be so much fun. And then that night I was like, oh, I can't do this again.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this weird, funny combo. But I think it's more just like allocating the right amount of resources to it.
Right. To me, it's just so hard to like say I'm going to not worry about paid stuff and just put all my focus on this unpaid thing that might add up to nothing. But they always add up to something.
They always add up to something. And also, I wrote it while I was on a paid gig.
Right. And yeah, I guess that helps.
And so this was just the first weekend that... everyone was free after my paid gig was done. That is the beauty of a short. It's easier to pull off a short than to write a feature while you're also on a paid gig. It's 10 pages, right. You know?
Well, I just got a text. This is live update for the podcast. My pilot shoot just pushed.
Oh, man.
The main talent backed out. Ugh.
Crazy.
Officially.
The life
we talked
of
about this probably happening, but man, that's what happens in this town. That's why I got to get 10 jobs lined up. I mean, I think it'll still happen, but... now it might intersect with another job. Ugh. So anyhow, well, cool. Well, yeah, so the final thing I want to talk about, and we save it for the end because I think we realize that a lot of people will not care about this at all. But I wanted to just talk about unions for a minute. I am personally not in any unions. My wife is in SAG, and because she's in that union, You know, one of the things you get from being in a union is obviously protections, like, and a lot of help making sure you're not being put into dangerous situations, but also a lot of times they will help you with your pension and your health insurance. And I think the health insurance is the thing that, as you become a professional freelancer in film, is really important. And so we get all of our health insurance for our whole family through my wife, because she's in SAG.
That's pretty nice. Yeah.
For us, obviously, there's a DGA, which would provide something similar for us. But just like SAG and those other guilds, the advantages of being in the DGA is you get all that stuff, and you're on this list of, and you're available to do these like really great big projects. But the disadvantage is that it's harder for you to work on non-DGA projects, which a lot of the branded content and commercials and things that we work on are non-DGA.
Yeah, there's a transitional period where when you go into a union where like all of the old jobs that you were maybe making a living on, you can't take those anymore, but you don't have as many new jobs knocking at your door yet. You know, you don't have the same sort of contacts and the same sort of pool.
Right.
So it's a tricky transition. I know a lot of our peers that have gone DGA, you know, it's a rough first year unless they've got something really awesome lined up, and that's the reason they're going DGA.
Right. Or they get to direct things, but they're off the books. So like when I did my Comcast job, most of the people I was working with are Producers Guild, Directors Guild, Union, and they were like, should we put your name on the casting notice and on the permit? And I was like, as director, I was like, yeah, sure, I don't care. And they're like, okay, because if you're in DGA, you wouldn't want that because this is a non-DGA project.
Right.
And so for those that don't know, the DGA obviously covers directors, it's a director's guild, but also covers first ADs, second ADs.
UPMs.
Yeah, there's a bunch of other people. And then the other guild, obviously, that people know about is the WGA, the Writers Guild. And then all the other unions, the below-the-line unions, are all kind of grouped together under an organization called IATSE. And so that's like, in those unions tend to have numbers, like local 80 is the grip union.
Right.
And oddly enough, also craft services in that union, right? Costumes have their own union, electricians, 728, you know, all the lighting people, 600, right, all the camera people. And so the unions obviously are a really great thing for people. If you are an electrician, you work in lighting for 30 years, like the only way you can get insurance and retirement is if you're in a union, right? So it's like a giant, it's like an awesome thing to be in a union.
It also makes sure that the number of people that are hired on a job is commensurate with the size and scale of the job. So like a producer can't skimp on like, well, I'm just going to hire one guy when it should be four, you know? That's
right.
Part of it as well. Like you have protections, basically. You have a person to call if you're being abused.
And what we said about the trucks earlier, like you bring the Teamster union in, they will be towing the generator and driving the big trucks and not making some 18-year-old PA pick up some truck and tow a generator and have that generator fall off their truck on the freeway, like happened to me.
Right.
Because
they don't know what they're doing, right? You know.
Right. And they enforce meal penalties, which means you have to get fed every 6 hours. And if you don't, then you have to get paid for not eating. They also enforce overtime and turnaround, which means that you have to go home for a certain amount of time and get a night's sleep before you have to be back at work again.
All of which sounds like, oh, common decency, and like it makes complete sense. But those protections are there for a reason. You know,
right,
like the point of it all, producers would look at numbers and say, oh, well, what if we fudge this? What if we fudge that? What if someone doesn't sleep
as much? It's only another 15 minutes.
Right, exactly. Well,
everyone's like, that's fine, but everyone's going to get paid another 15 minutes worth of salary. And a lot of that stuff coincides with California labor law. Like, obviously, in California, there's minimum wage. You have to get fed every once in a while. You have to get
breaks,
overtime automatically certain times. So anyway, so why on earth would you ever do a shoot non-union? What's your answer?
Well, the answer is because in order to join a union, you have to have had the experience. The other thing about unions is that they guarantee a certain level of competence, right?
Right.
And so
you're made official as that position.
You're bona fide.
You're kind of certified.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So as a result, though, you have to gain that experience some way. So you need to work non-union in order to kind of learn how to do all of those jobs before you can collect your hours and join one of those unions. So that's one good reason. The other reason is just like, the barrier to entry in general is just much lower. And so if you're new in town and you don't have a network yet, and you're just trying to, like, you know, make rent, like, there are producers out there, some of whom are unscrupulous and some of them who are just, like, digital or new or whatever, who will hire you for typically a much lower rate than a union job would be, and still try and produce some cool content.
Right. So I think it's beyond obvious why someone would take a non-union job. But why, like, let's say you're short last week, why was that not a union project? If you want to hire good people and take good care of them.
Sure. Money. Yeah, money is the exact right. reason. There were people there who were there as a favor. You know, there were people there when they were getting paid, they were getting paid more as a stipend or as a thank you than an actual day's work. You know, no one was paid anywhere near what they are worth. None of them.
Right. So, yeah. So on my job, you know, it was a commercial job. We had a budget. It was a big client. And so I asked, like, well, and, you know, a lot of the people that worked on it were union. And so I asked the people that decide whether a job is union or non-union. It's like, why don't we just make it union from the beginning, right? Like, we want to treat everyone well. We want everyone to be safe. We want everyone to be happy. What is the disadvantage of going union? And yeah, the answer is everything becomes way more expensive,
yeah.
right? Someone has to pay for that health insurance that the union gives you.
So
right?
yeah.
You have to pay into their health, into their pension. You have to bring on drivers that cost, you know, $45 an hour or whatever, that have to come in 2 hours before the day starts and go through like 2 hours after the day ends. So they're automatically getting a ton of overtime. You know that on a union shoot, you need Teamsters to drive you for the location scout.
Oh,
you can't just
yeah.
have the director and the DP drive.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
that's automatically like, oh, there's like another $800
right.
that we weren't expecting to spend. So, you know, when a client comes to you and they say, hey, we have $100,000 for a commercial and we want you to do this and this and this. If you calculate it with the union fees, it'll come out to $200,000.
Right.
Right. So you have to say to them, you either don't get the job or you try to shoot non-union, which, you know, I guess is what happened with us. Now, so how does a shoot get flipped from non-union to union?
Right. So typically what happens is, like, I think someone on the crew takes a look around. They say, they count how many awesome, like, big trucks you've got and how many people are there. And they say to themselves, it looks like this production company has enough money to pay people unions, and they're not. So they send.
Right. Or oftentimes they'll say, like, ooh, this is a giant.
Yeah.
You know, it's Ford, it's Toyota, it's
yeah, yeah.
NBC, rich people. And they're trying to rip us off by being non-union.
And there's enough money at stake that they need to finish this job. Like, it's not a thing where Toyota will just be like, well, never mind then. They've spent 6 months developing the, you know, the spots and all of this stuff. So they feel like there's enough invested that people are just going to, you know, need to follow through on it.
It's probably worth mentioning that almost every job that flips from non-union to union is a multi-day job.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's totally true. So someone typically just sends a call sheet, puts a call into their local union and says, like, hey, I think.
Right. So they have to be a union member.
Right.
They're typically a union member, right?
Typically, but not always, actually. It doesn't have to be. I think that I remember when I was younger, a lot of my friends got into the union because of a flip, and like they were ready to send in a call sheet. They were like looking for it. They were like this is the way to do it.
Right. One of the ways to get into a union, you have to have worked a certain number of union days in order to get into the union.
Right.
But you don't get the union jobs if you're not in the union. So the best way to get in is to work a non-union job that becomes union while you're on it.
So it really depends on what side of the fence you're on. But like I remember coming up, especially my camera friends would refer to it as getting lucky. Like they all joined the union not through having to work, you know, 800 days or whatever it is, probably 100 non-union days or something like that. It's probably bonkers the number of hours you have to get, or you just flip. And so, like, from their perspective, it was like, you know, it was a windfall.
I do remember, like, when I was doing more grip and electric work, like, some people would be like, oh, you want to get on this movie? Word is that it's probably going to flip.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Which is what happened, I think, with mine. I think there was a little bit of whispering of, like, ah, this is big enough. It's like, it was 5 days of shooting. So about halfway through, there was like a picket line and everything. Everyone left at lunch and, you know, lawyers got on the phone and worked it out.
What would you say is kind of in LA, like the line that would flip a shoot? Like if you're doing a shoot for $10,000, there's like no chance it'll flip. If you're doing a shoot for $1 million, there's a very high chance it'll flip.
Yeah, you know,
and somewhere in the middle is 50-50 chance.
Yeah, I think your instinct of like how many days it's shooting for is right. That's going to be a big factor in it, because like it does take time to actually, you know, send in that call sheet and like make sure that everything checks out. And like oftentimes the unions will call in advance, you know, if it's a big company, they'll like be like, hey, you know, we're considering this, what do you have to say? They want the easiest response as possible. And I think in my case, the company I was working for was playing a little hardball, I think. I don't know.
Right. So in your case, when you talk about the picket line, it's basically everyone on the crew that is in the union says, the union says, hey, we're striking.
No. Everyone. Everyone who ever has the hope of ever being in a union. So
really?
Whether they were in the union or not, they got a phone call from their local chapter that was like, hey, Orin, if you ever want to join my union, you've got to leave this set now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was only the union people.
And so it you know, I've talked about it. At the time, it was really hard to not take personally, because
right.
a lot of my friends, people I'd worked with for years, just kind of quietly slipped out at lunch.
Oh, yeah. Well, now that it's happened to me, we didn't have the picket line. We just kept going. We were like literally halfway through day two when the producer or the AD or someone mentioned to me, like, by the way, you know, we flipped, right? I was like, no, I had no idea. Oh, you know what? I think Miss 2059, my new form shoot, also flipped.
It did.
But it was
yeah.
like in retrospect. But I was like kind of upset because the reason I want to bring it up is because I think there's a little misconception, and I have my perspective. I mean, I could be wrong, but this is the way I see it. Like, you have a bunch of people. Our crew was treated so well. The days weren't hard. No, we were in great weather. The food was great. Everyone was appreciated. There was like no disgruntled workers that I know of,
mm-hmm.
right? But I think the people that are calling and trying to flip the shoot are like, hey, this is a giant client. They have a ton of money. You know, there's a bunch of us here in the union. Look at all the trucks. Look at all the crew. Look at all this stuff. Like, this should be a union shoot. We're going to flip it, and we're going to, like, screw the client, this giant corporation, right? And so when it flips, they feel like, oh, awesome. Now we're getting our insurance. We're getting our pension. We're getting our safety concerns addressed. And we're screwing this giant corporation that who gives a shit, right?
Right.
But I guess the way I see it is that giant corporation doesn't care if it's union or not union. And if the shoot flips, they're not giving one more cent to the shoot. The
right.
entity that takes the hit is the production company,
mm-hmm.
right?
It depends actually on who negotiated the contract. The production,
which contract?
The contract between the production company and the agency, or the agency and the corporation. I know that in some cases, the agency pays and not the production company.
Well, interesting. Well, it's probably pretty rare that the client pays, the name that everyone sees.
Right, yeah. Coca-Cola is never paying for whether or not it's agent.
Right. So you're working on a Coke commercial, and it flips union. Coke is not paying anymore. Someone is losing that additional money. And yes, it's a risk. It's a calculated risk that a company takes to go non-union on a shoot that is borderline flippable.
Right.
Right? But the repercussions now is now this production company is going to say like, well, you know what? Now we're not going to do multi-day shoots in LA anymore because we can't go union because we can't afford, you know, we would never get the job if it was union because we don't have enough money based on the budget.
Yeah.
So in order to get the job, we have to go non-union. If we go non-union, we can't shoot in LA. And now I'm like, I love shooting in LA. It's like, I get to go home at night. I get to hire all the best people in the world to work on this stuff.
Your money isn't going
great
towards
crews,
like
great
lodging people or flying them anywhere.
Right. We have the best actors in the world here. Like, now I have to go cast out of somewhere else. And it's like, now there's all these little cities like Phoenix, I heard, is an up and coming city to fly some cast in.
Yeah.
It's pretty inexpensive to put them up and fly them over there. And there's no union issues, you know? I don't know. It's I guess I did take it personally because I felt like, it's not that I took it personally, I felt like the crew kind of felt like they had this big win over the evil corporation, where in reality, they had a small win over the small company that's now losing a lot of money on this job and will probably not hire these people again. You know, I mean, I hope they will. I'm going to fight to hire them again and to figure it out, to go to union whenever we can.
Right.
But the problem is, if I'm getting multi-million dollar commercials, obviously we go union. But if I'm getting a $200,000 commercial, it's probably going to be non-union.
Right.
And the other place is SAG, you know, which I freaking love SAG. Every single job I ever get, I'm like, let's make this SAG. We will get the best actors in the world. And every time the client's like, nah, we've decided to not go SAG. We don't want to pay residuals. And it's like, ugh.
Yeah.
So frustrating. So I just, I don't know. I usually do not really care much about unions, and I would never think it's an interesting topic for our podcast, but only because I was so immersed in it last week, I wanted to bring it up. And I'm sure some people, especially some of our listeners that are more like DPs, gaffers, and, you know, costume designers are working on various sides of the camera, probably will get into it when they're in LA at some point, or if they're in LA right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, it's just that we're in such a transitional period. And now that streaming media and online media is like lucrative, I think that the unions have to figure it out. And I think that they maybe ignored it early on, and now they don't have as much jurisdiction over it. And so it's created this glut of non-union work that I think is ultimately hurting all of us, and that we won't be able to retire.
Yeah. Well, it's a catch 22. Cause I agree. That's exactly my theory too. Like, why is there so much non-union work now? You know, when Coke used to say, we're going to spend $1 million advertising Coke Zero, they would go and they'd make 2 30-second commercials,
right,
and air them. Right. Now they make 2 30-second commercials, like a 45-second commercial, a branded content thing, like 10 socials, this all for that same $1 million. So now the budgets are so tiny that Coke is still spending the same amount of money, but they're trying to make 10 times as many things. And it's good because there's more content and there's more work for creators and directors and crews like us. But it sucks because there's way less money. So the nice thing is when you're not working on commercials, when you're working on TV and movies, you don't really have to worry about that as much.
Right.
Right. You just worry about making good stuff and not reaching all these different demos in weird ways. So anyhow, on that note, should we move into unpaid endorsements?
Unpaid endorsements!
Oren, what you got?
Well, going back to my shoot, I hate myself for not knowing the name of the software, but maybe you will. On my Comcast shoot, we had a VTR person, mm-hmm, which is awesome. I've had them before, but usually they're kind of the first person to go, you know, yeah, with the drone operator,
yeah,
when you're trying to cut the budget down. But so the VTR person, they kind of take a big load off of the camera department because they're setting up all the monitors for the client, mm-hmm, and for the director. They have their own monitors and they can play back any clip, right? You're like, hey, play back that last take. So on this shoot specifically, we had the very final shot of each spot was a split screen between two different living rooms and the couches and the coffee tables and the artwork on the back. Mm-hmm. Everything had to line up perfectly. So we had our VTR guy, you know, play the shot from our previous location, do a split screen with our current camera shot, and that way we can,
mm-hmm, no,
dress
for sure,
our shot,
yeah,
to make it line up perfectly. So I also pulled the Matt Enlow and I was like, hey, I'd love to have a remote monitor.
Yeah, buddy. Right?
And usually the past few times I've done that, they've given me these handles with the Anton Bauer, like a giant,
uh-huh,
like,
yeah,
5-pound battery on the back of like a small HD monitor. I'm carrying this thing around, keep putting it down because it's so heavy. What they gave me this time was a freaking iPad, like a super light iPad.
Oh,
had this program on it called like Q-Frame or something. Mm-hmm. I'll try to find the name. But it was so light. It had the camera image, you know, through Wi-Fi. If there were two cameras, he could put it in split screen, or I can tap and, mm-hmm, full screen each camera. And I can just carry it with me. It was just awesome. It was just like a really, really amazing experience. So VTR, I don't know. I guess like even on a low budget shoot, you could probably, without a VTR person, just get that program and the transmitter and have the monitor in your pocket,
yeah,
like if you had an iPad mini or something.
I wonder how they I feel like I've only heard of those sorts of options with VTR people, because also like you can give a code and then it can just stream to your phone. So you can give it to clients. Yeah. So everybody has a monitor if they want one, you know, yeah. just in their
you
pocket. Just,
you might have to install the app. Yeah. But it's awesome. And you get all the camera information. You get, yeah. The one thing I couldn't figure out, which I'm sure you could do, is how to do a screen capture. But how cool is it? Like while you're shooting, you're like, oh, wait, let's remember this setup, screen capture, and now let's change the art around or wardrobe or whatever. So, yeah, if you go to my Instagram, which is at O Kaplan?
Yeah.
Oren Kaplan?
Yeah, it's O Kaplan.
I actually have no idea what my Instagram is. You can see a picture that I took of the screen, of the iPad screen, and it's pretty awesome. It's a picture of me on camera because I had the monitor with me.
Oh, fun.
So anyhow, I guess that's my unpaid endorsement is the iPad VTR. Very unspecific.
Pretty great. You know what, Oren? I'm going to endorse, we talked about it already, but I'm going to endorse keeping a spreadsheet of all of your contacts for cruise.
Use Google Docs?
Yeah, it's a Google Doc. Yeah, and then it just makes it really easy to copy and paste anytime someone is asking or you just need to refresh your memory on somebody. Yeah, having a Google Doc with all of those. And then also, I think sorting them by city is really nice as well because then anytime you go to a city, you can sort and be like, oh, I know these people who are available in this city. And that's really nice as well. And you can also, I have a friend who does it for just any person that she knows. And so she always remembers like, oh, I'm in New York right now. I should hit up these people.
Mm. So after a shoot, you just take the call sheet and call just sheet, put it all in there?
Yep.
One by one, manually?
Yeah. I mean, you can copy and paste stuff, but like, it's not that hard. And it's not like I pull every person. It's when I'm like, I really like this person. Yeah, exactly. You don't want to endorse someone you don't believe in or stand behind.
Yeah, it would be cool if you could actually just stick the call sheets into like, I wish you could like embed files into those Google Docs spreadsheets in an easy way that's not so clunky.
Yeah, but you don't want all of that extra gack. You don't need to know where the nearest hospital was. You just want to know, who was my gaffer on that job? Oh, I really liked him or her.
Good endorsement.
Thanks, buddy.
Good endorsement.
Cool.
Well, if you guys want to endorse anything, let us know what you think of the show. Email us. We love getting your emails. Even if we don't respond to you always, we read everything and intend to respond to everything at some point.
I think we get back to you eventually. Just kind of depends on how busy we are and how long we're in front of a computer.
You can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We're at justshootitpod everywhere.
Leave us a voicemail. We love getting your voicemails. 2626-SHOOT-1.
And if you have left us a voicemail and we haven't played it yet, we are going to. We're going to do an episode of listener questions coming up soon. You can follow me on Instagram at okaplan or check out my website at directedbyoren.com.
You can check me out at Mr. Matt Enlow on all social platforms. And you can check out the Just Shoot It Twitter at Just Shoot It Pod. We're doing some cool stuff over there trying to get that community growing.
Yeah, Just Shoot It is produced by Madeline Rosewatt. This episode was edited by Jay McAuliffe, and our webmaster is Ewan Williams. The music is provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Leave us an iTunes review.
Thanks, everyone.
We'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.